Hey everyone, welcome to The Conversation. This podcast is produced by Capital Community Church located in Fredericton, New Brunswick. If you're in the area, we would love the chance to connect with you. So you're invited. Come join us on campus for one of our weekly services. We would be honored to meet you. For more information, you can check out our website, capitalcommunity.ca. At this point, if you're a regular listener to The Conversation, you're probably wondering who I am. Well, I'm Brandon Pike, and I'm the media director here at CCC. There are two reasons why I'm doing this introduction today. The first being is that Pastor Matt is currently away on a well-deserved vacation. The second reason being is that next month, Pastor Matt is actually going to be interviewing myself for The Conversation. We are going to be discussing our tech and media workflows here at CCC. We will be discussing anything from video, social media, sound, ProPresenter, YouTube, and even our podcast setup. So if you have any questions about something you've seen us do or anything related to church media and tech, please send your questions to online at capitalcommunity.ca and we will do our best to answer those questions in our next episode, and that information will be available in the description. Now on to today's episode. Pastor Matt had the opportunity to sit down with missionary to Guatemala, Brad Thompson. Brad Thompson is no stranger to Capital Community Church. In fact, before Brad went to Guatemala, he used to be on staff at CCC when we were First United Pentecostal Church. In this episode, Brad talks about the keys to growth and success in Guatemala. He reminisces about his upbringing and his early years working here at CCC and how those and other experiences prepared him for being a missionary. So thanks again for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the conversation.
Everybody, and welcome to the podcast today. Thanks for joining the conversation. And I want to say a big thank you to a great friend of this local church and a good friend of ours, Brother Brad Thompson. He is in town, and I am very thankful that you've taken the time to join us today on the podcast. I'm going to give you an opportunity here. Why don't you go ahead and greet everybody that's tuned in for the episode today?
Well, it is definitely an honor to be here today, and love CCC and the pastoral staff here, and it's just a joy to be able to greet everyone from the country of Guatemala, but I guess right now it's from the city of Fredericton.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you are husband to Regina, you are father to Anthony, Ryan, and Tyrell, and I trust your family's doing very good.
Family is doing very well.
Awesome. Yes.
Yeah, all is well.
Now, we were just kind of bantering a little bit in the office as you were coming in for the recording today, and so, of course, Brad Thompson, but you said in Guatemala they struggle. They typically go by a first name basis. It's not so much the brother Thompson, but they tend to struggle with your first name. Tell us about this.
Yes. So in Guatemala, last names are very confusing because everyone has two last names. And when someone gets married, you drop one and add another, and it gets extremely confusing. So everybody goes by first name basis. We're Brother Brad and Sister Regina. Well, they cannot say Brad. Brad is just a combination of letters that in Spanish do not work. So I get, when I first went to Guatemala, one of the girls in the church knew a little bit of English, enough to be dangerous, and she told everyone that my name was Hermano Pan, which is Brother Bread. She thought they were saying bread, and so the joke became that I was Brother Pun or Brother Bread. But in businesses, if I go in and I give my name, they call me, usually it's Break, Brand, Brick.
I just don't understand how you get from Brad to these names, but...
Well, the reason is because when they see an American name or a Canadian name or English name, they panic, they freeze. And in their mind, even if they could sound it out, because you can sound Brad out in Spanish, it would be Braid, but it gets worse. So they can sound it out, but they just panic. And even when they see like a white person or somebody from another country, they automatically think, I'm not going to be able to understand them. Mm. And even if you speak to them in their language, they'll get this like deer in the headlights look that I don't know what this person is saying when actually they do.
So your wife, Regina, she lucked out because her name is actually a Spanish name.
Yeah, Regina is Regina, which is a very Spanish name, and she does great with it. But I usually use my second name, especially in businesses. Now, in the church, they call me Hermano Brad. But most of them call me Hermano Brick, Hermano Brand, Hermano Brick. They can't really say it, but we use the name. And so in businesses, I use my second name because my second name is, I probably shouldn't say this publicly because I'll get this from people, but my second name is Ernest. And so they will call me Hermano Ernesto. Ernesto. And so I don't get Ernie.
I feel like we should redo the introduction to the podcast. It's really good to have Brother Ernesto Thompson here on the... No, I'm just teasing.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's called Ernest Goes to Podcast.
Oh, my goodness. That's hilarious. Well, sorry for your struggles and the woes. No.
If that was the limit of my struggles and woes, I'd be doing good.
You're doing pretty good. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So let's talk about history a little bit. Of course, you were born and raised in the city of Fredericton, correct?
Right, yes.
And for the earlier portion of your life, this was your home church. And so I wonder, as you think back on that season of your life, you also were on staff here for various stints as an outreach director.
Right.
So as you think back on that season of your life, whether that's early childhood or, you know, your time on staff, are there any fond memories that you would reminisce upon for us today?
Well, I think that, you know, our younger years are formation years, and Fredericton is a very big part of who I am and what formed and shaped me. Of course, I grew up in the church here in Fredericton. We have a lot of family, a lot of very dear friends that have meant so much and invested so much into our lives. It was this church that supported us so strongly when I went to Guatemala under the AIM program, which the AIM program is a program where you go and help missionaries. And so in our early years in missions, we went to Guatemala on three different occasions and would go, and we were helping Brother and Sister Windrost, and this local church was our support base. I mean, they totally supported us. And when I would come home for maybe it was 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, I would go back on staff here at the church working as outreach director, and absolutely loved it. And those years were my early ministry years, and they were years of a very strong formation. And I can thank Capital Community Church, which at the time was First United Pentecostal Church, and the church family for being patient with me and supporting us, and for having a huge part in the formation of who we are and our ideology for ministry, the way that we work, the way that we minister, the way that we care for people. Having been outreach director here, you know, a big part of my job was visiting the hospital, mm-hmm. visiting the elderly, working with Bible studies, new people, a lot of the visitation and touching of people was my job, and it really followed through our ministry, because I think ministry is caring for people. Ministry is, you know, we do teaching, we do preaching, but when it comes right down to it, the main part of ministry is touching people. I mean, Jesus went among the multitude, and he touched the people.
Yeah.
He was in there with them, and I think that that was probably one of the greatest things in my life. Of course, growing up in New Brunswick, it's easy to receive a call to missionary work. Somebody asked me one time, they said, "Why are there so many missionaries from Eastern Canada?" And I said, "Have you checked the weather? We'll go anywhere."
Yeah, to the land of perpetual spring,
yes,
in your case.
Guatemala is a land of eternal spring. I mean, we deal with 70 to 75 degree weather most of the year. And so, yeah, like, hello.
So you would have known, I know my father, Pastor Raymond, he was on staff during that season as well here at the church. Pastor Lehman, I'm trying to think, would he have been in Bible college at that time? Did you know him? Did you know the...
During that time, Brother Lehman would have been in St. John. He hadn't gone to Bible school yet.
Okay, it was before that
time. Yeah, he's so much younger, but, you know, he has all that gray hair and stuff, so he doesn't really look as young as he is.
Yeah, I feel I feel like we might as well. So, any memories of my father, Pastor Raymond, during that time?
Actually, the Woodward family has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember, from very, very early years. And then, of course, going up through school, your grandfather was my high school principal.
Right. Yes. Okay.
And just your grandparents were, and your Uncle Glenn, we were pretty much the same age. And, you know, I've known your family all of our life. So when I was on staff here at the church in Marysville, Brother Raymond Woodward, who I also grew up with, was the music director here. And I was there was about four of us, I think, on staff, off and on. And so, you know, Raymond Woodward was always, like, in high school, he was smarter than everybody. He never gave you that impression, but he was. He was so intelligent. And then coming on staff here, he taught in the Bible school. In fact, in my last year, he taught us a couple classes in Bible school, and then I came on staff, and he was a music director. And as music director, he was one of these people that was always very sensitive to know exactly what song to sing when and what to say and how to minister. He just had an anointing, but also just a way about him that not every music director has, and he just would flow. Now, there were times, you know, that was the beginning of his ministry as well. So we look at him now and we see all of the great teachings that he gives and the depth in which of his knowledge. And so often, I mean, he's come to Guatemala, and when he teaches, our ministers just kind of like sit there open mouthed and thinking, how, in fact, they've asked him, how did you learn that? Where did you get that from? Well, I can tell you where he got that from, because we were on staff together. And I remember we would have revival meetings, and we would be working to set everything up, and we would be like, where's Raymond? And he wasn't there. And we were like cleaning, and we were setting stuff up, and we were moving things around, and we were organizing, getting ready for the event. And two or three, four, sometimes 5 days would go by, and he wouldn't come to the office. He wasn't around. And as staff, you know, we felt like, well, like, he should be here working. And we would kind of grumble and complain among ourselves. But what he was often doing was he would be home in his office, and he would get this line of study, and he would not come out of the house or out of the office until he followed it through and got full understanding of what he was studying. Well, at the time, we could have cared less. Because, like, we were all on staff, and he wasn't, you know, in our mind's eye, he wasn't, you know, carrying his weight of the load.
Yeah.
And so the event would come, and we would be, you know, we would have everything done. He would walk in, he would do the music, he would knock it out of the park, and we were not probably the most spiritual beings at the time. It would make us so mad. Well, now, looking back on it, 35, almost 40 years later, the entire United Pentecostal Church and beyond are benefiting from those early years that he poured into study and understanding the word and getting, you know, following through those thoughts of study. So I guess probably the frustrations that we felt back then have paid off a million times over.
He's paid it back a little bit coming to Guatemala over the years.
Oh, he's paid it back a whole lot. And so I shouldn't even mention that. But it is kind of interesting, because that's a side that nobody really maybe sees or knows. And even at that time, we didn't understand what was happening. Mm-hmm. But God understood what was happening.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for it now.
Well, thank you for reminiscing a bit. I just think that's cool. Sometimes, even growing up in my family's home, of course, you don't get the full picture. So it's kind of interesting to get little snapshots from people from that time. So thank you.
Yeah, he probably will pull my PIM.
Well, we'll see. We'll advocate for you. I want to ask you, your parents are sweet people and longtime members of this church, Fred and Ruby Thompson. And thinking back on maybe some earlier years before your time starting in ministry and whatnot, what are some of the things, or whatever season, it doesn't matter, I suppose, but what are some of the things that you would point to and say, my parents did this really well? What are some things your parents did right?
I think one of the, I mean, they did great raising us as parents. But I really think that one of the things they displayed, two things they displayed, was faithfulness and servanthood. My parents were very faithful, and what you see them on the street is what you would see them at home. They were very keen on making sure that we were in a good church, a church that preached the Word of God, a place where we could be brought up and grow up in a very healthy, spiritual, safe atmosphere. But one of the big things was service. They have always been servants in the church and out of the church. Growing up, my parents were Sunday school superintendents for many years. Dad led the song service in our local church, and they involved us in everything they did. If it was Sunday school, we would be, you know, putting together new Sunday school material for, I mean, we were just kids, and we'd be involved in that. For Sunday school, Christmas programs, we were so involved in the behind the scenes. We started teaching Sunday school. I started teaching Sunday school, I was a kid myself. I would be in my very early teens when I started teaching Sunday school, and maybe even 12. I think probably I filled in a few times in the kindergarten class when I was like even as young as 12. But not just in church, but my dad would always, like if an old elderly person needed the house painted, he would go and paint the house. If they needed the yard mowed or the yard shoveled out, he would do that. And we had neighbors around us that were elderly. One that comes to my mind in particular is Sister Marie McConaughey, who was the wife of a pioneer minister here in North America. And I remember many times Dad would send me over to shovel the snow or cut her grass. And he would always say, do not take any money from her. Do not let her pay you.
Yeah.
And that, like that just, and he would say, you know, she's a pioneer widow of a pioneer pastor, and we want to help her. And they were always picking people up for church, and we would pick up college students and take them. In fact, there was a period of time where there were several students from Africa, from Kenya and Swaziland and Nigeria that were in college at University of New Brunswick. We would pick them up and take them to church. Many of them were baptized. In fact, one of them, when they had their first son, they named them after, he named him after my dad.
Wow.
And they would, mom and dad would bring them to our house for Christmas. They'd bring them to our house for special occasions. And so they were very giving, very serving people.
Very, very others conscious.
Very others conscious.
Yeah.
And they drilled that into us.
Wow.
You know, they were never, you know, preachers or anything like that, but they were very ministry conscious. They had a deep respect for ministry, and I think that really had an impact on our lives as kids, because, I mean, I went into ministry, and my sister went into ministry, and that was huge.
So one thing that you mentioned, and I think it's worthy of note, around the time that you were going to Guatemala, I don't know if this was one of your AIM terms or more of a permanent situation, but one of your sisters, one of your two sisters tragically passed. And you just mentioned something before we hit record, just that despite that difficult season, it was within proximity just prior to you going to Guatemala, and you really were considering pulling the plug, yet even in that difficult season, your parents very much advocated for you to follow the will of God for your life. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I was in my last year of Bible college. It would have been in January, and my oldest sister, Bonnie, was hit by a car and killed. And that was the first part of January. I was to go to Guatemala in May. It was my first trip on AIM to Guatemala. I had not been there yet. And when all of that happened, I felt there's no way I can leave my parents and go to Guatemala. I mean, we just lost Bonnie. And there's no way I can do that. And when I expressed that to my parents, it was almost like they were appalled at the idea. And they were very adamant that I continue with the plan. They didn't want to stand in the way of the will of God. And, you know, that was the darkest season in my parents' life, the losing of a daughter, and in the life of our family. But they were very adamant that I do what God opened the door for me to do. And I mean, 37 years later, I'm still in Guatemala. I mean, at that time, they had no idea that it would be a lifetime of missionary service, but they let me go.
Even in the midst of, like you said, such a dark season, they had enough sense, kingdom, they were kingdom-minded enough. And like you said, the years have borne out that that was the right decision for them.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Were there any early exposures? Of course, you know, you went on AIM, and that's, of course, a great exposure to the mission field, in particular, in your case, Guatemala. Were there any early exposures in your life as a kid, growing up in the church and Sunday school, that kind of planted the seed of missions at an early age, would you say?
I mean, definitely. First of all, you cannot be a young person or a child in the Atlantic District of the United Pentecostal Church and not have missions at the forefront. We have had so many great missionaries come from this area of the world and literally go around the world. And so, yes, at a very young age, I was very missions conscious. I knew what a missionary was. I didn't really know all they did, but there was a great respect and awe. My grandmother was a cousin to Bill Drost, who was a missionary in South America and Spain. And when they would come on furlough, they would a lot of times come and base out of my grandmother's house, which was two doors down from us. And I remember many times as a young child sitting on the front porch, you know, and these great missionaries would be there, and you were just like in awe, like, you know, it was like the prophet has come home, you know, and like my parents had such a high respect. And any time that Brother Bill and Sister Ruth Drost and their family would come, or Wayne Drost or Wynn Drost, and they would, you know, come to my grandmother's house, or whether it be, you know, any of them, Gerald and Dawn sometimes, I think, it was a big thing.
Sure.
It was a huge thing. It was like royalty was coming to town. And so I grew up in that. And listening about Brother Vernon Larson and some of those others, it just was something that was very much ingrained into us. And then when I was in my youth, Brother and Sister George Shom, who had been missionaries for many years in India and involved in Pakistan, and then their sons, especially Warren and Lyndon, would come, and they made their home base my home church. And we spent many days at Brother and Sister Shom's home. And Brother Shom, at the time I worked at Kmart on the top of Smythe Street, and Brother Shom lived just a couple blocks away, and sometimes he would walk up there to Kmart, and I would be working. I worked on the kind of the outside because I worked where all the plants were and all that stuff.
Sure.
And he would stand there and talk to me about missions.
Wow.
And I remember when I first went to Guatemala on AIM, Brother Shom said to me, he said, "All those times I talked to you about missions, it wasn't about Central America." You know, he was pulling for Asia. But, and Sister Shom was our very first missionary partner to sign up with us. Sister Margaret Shom.
Wow, that's
our
amazing.
Our very first partner. They really believed in us, and they really, you know, they had a great impact on our life as far as missions is concerned. So that's one area. Then the other area, and we were talking about this earlier, when I was 10, we had a Sunday school contest at church. This is the old Argyle Street Church.
Okay, yeah.
Way back. I'm old. Brother Donnie Vincent was my Sunday school teacher, and we were having a Sunday school contest, and that contest was, you know, whoever had the most visitors, had the most memory verses memorized, who was most faithful to Sunday school, would win this set of mystery books, and they were Danny Orless Christian Mystery Series, and I was an avid reader, and I was going to win those books. I wanted those books. And so I did everything I could. I invited everybody I could to church. I memorized all the verses. I was faithful. I did everything I could to win it. And at the end of the day, I won that set of books. And so I was so cool. I was so excited. Well, Danny Orlis's parents were missionaries. Mm-hmm. And they were missionaries in the southern part of Mexico. And they traveled into Guatemala quite a bit. And some of the mysteries took place literally in Guatemala.
Wow.
And I remember as a kid, I would go to bed at night and I would cover my head up with the blankets and I would have my flashlight out because I was so into these books. Like, I wanted to see what happened. And the cool thing was, like, they, at that time I thought Guatemala was like in Africa. I didn't know that it was in Central America. And I didn't even know Central America existed back then. But I would read and it would be like he was in Naba and he was going down this river and he was with the Ashil people and he was, you know, words that meant nothing to me now, but I've been to all of those places now.
That's amazing.
But I really believe, looking back on it, that God was planting a seed in my heart for Guatemala and for the Spanish people and for that area, because the area they were in was very much the Mayan Indian people, where we have churches now in 16 different Mayan languages, which is totally cool. But I really believe that in those early years, as a 10-year-old, that God was planting the seed for Guatemala.
Yeah.
You know,
through a Sunday school book giveaway competition.
Yes. So you don't know. And, you know, some of the people that greatly, I'm actually in the process of writing a book concerning our ministry and the work in Guatemala. And I'm dealing with some of the people that had an impression on my life. One of them was a Sunday school teacher I had who has long since passed away, Sister Melva Bavis. And I remember her, I was just a little kid. I don't even know what age group she would have taught, but it would have been before I was 10. Mm-hmm. She was a Sunday school teacher who I wanted to love God like she did, because it just, to me, it just radiated off of her. And when she taught Sunday school, it wasn't like she was teaching. She was just sharing her heart with us as kids. And there was just something like, I wanted a God like she had.
Mm.
And so I say that because as Sunday school teachers, you know, sometimes, and I'll say we, because I was a Sunday school teacher as well, we don't really realize what we have in our hands. But we've got kids in our hands that we don't know who they will be.
Right.
They could be a future missionary. They could be the future pastor of this local church. They could be the future premier of New Brunswick. Like, we don't know where God's going to lead them and what's going to God do with their life. But we have an opportunity, just a slice of opportunity, to really impact their lives. And I think that that we need to do everything that we can to take advantage of those moments we have with those kids. And you may be the only godly influence some of those kids have.
Right. Yeah. You just never know the situation they're coming from.
And here I am, you know, 50 years later, remembering the fervency of the love that that teacher had for God.
That's amazing.
And that has stayed with me.
Well, and you just don't know. It's kind of like long-term investments. You know, sometimes you pour into kids. And I haven't been specifically in children's ministry. I've been in youth ministry. Sometimes you feel like, or you wonder, am I getting through? Am I making an impact? I mean, they're kids, right?
But you are.
But you are. You're planting that seed. Yeah. That's amazing.
And it will never be forgotten. You know, and you may never live, I hope you do, yes, to see the full result.
Yeah.
Like, that Sunday school teacher died many, many years ago and never knew I went to Guatemala. But I think her investment lives on.
Yeah.
And that's the cool thing.
That is cool.
And I do that in Guatemala. I remember the very first time I started teaching in the Bible school there 37 years ago, I looked at it like I had, I think it was 21 students at the time. And I looked at, this is 21 opportunities to multiply my ministry.
Yeah.
I may never go where they go, but a part of me is going to go with them.
Well, that's true discipleship, right?
It's totally discipleship and training.
Replicating who you are in others.
And to me, that's probably that's been the highlight and the main focus of our ministry for 37 years. It's been training and equipping and just simply pouring yourself into other people.
So that's kind of a good segue, I think, into maybe another subject matter here. But, you know, the work in Guatemala has evidently, obviously thrived over the 37 years. Mm-hmm. It was nearly, in fact, next month, It will be 8 years ago that we sat down for an interview, the inaugural traffic talk episode.
Thankfully, we didn't crash.
Yes, we're still alive today. Thank the Lord. But it was there in that episode, in that interview, and I was actually just revisiting it. Didn't want to be redundant today, so I was listening back through a little bit. And you made a statement that at that time, almost 8 years ago, there were 42 churches being built, like, simultaneously that day, or, you know, like, during that time. So obviously, like, when you're building 42 of anything at one time, you know, something is going right. So just really quickly, I'll get the question out, yeah, and I'll let you speak, but... You know, what would you say have been the keys to kingdom success in Guatemala in the work there under your leadership over the years?
Okay. And I'll just mention this. Right now, I have 38 church buildings under construction. So. Those 42 are done, thankfully. But we've maintained, it's kind of freaky because we've kind of maintained an average of 40 churches being under construction.
That's something
for
else.
Years.
Wow.
And so we have 38 right now. In fact, I'm trying to get them finished by the end of this year.
The 38 currently.
The 38, yeah.
And then on to the next 40.
Oh, praise God. Yes. So really, the base of our work in Guatemala from the very beginning has been training. I think as a missionary, you're constantly working to work yourself out of a job. When I went to Guatemala, the work was small. It was new. I remember the first year we had no youth department, and we started a youth department, and I was the first youth president for the work in Guatemala. But my job as youth president wasn't just to be the youth president, but it was to train that next person that would take my position. And all through our ministry in Guatemala, as we took one position after another, it was just a temporary step because you're constantly working yourself out of a job and training someone else to take it to the next level.
Could I just interject and ask, do you think that missions work generally kind of incentivizes that more because of things like deputation where you're forced to leave the field, you know, time and time again? So you have to have somebody that's going to be there to run with it when you're gone.
Yes, I think that definitely has a huge part in it. The other part is that you are temporary. Mm-hmm. You're a missionary to there. You're not long-term, and your goal is to produce a mature work that can stand on its own feet. It's kind of like raising a child. Mm-hmm. Like, you take the child up to when they're 18, then they go on to college, and then they get married, and you hope and pray that during those 18 years that you had direct contact with them, that you put enough principles and qualities in them that they will lead a successful life when they leave you. It doesn't mean that you're not still a part of their life, but they've matured and they can now stand on their own and they create their own family and the cycle goes on.
Right.
So I look at the work in Guatemala really the same way, and I think any work is like this. Your goal is to take a work that is young and mature it. You train, you equip them so that they can stand on their own two feet. With making their leadership decisions, with vision casting, with love for truth, just so many different areas, you want to get it to a place where it can walk on its own. So in Guatemala, for instance, 15 years ago, which would have been,
2007?
Yes, probably. I think it was 2007, 2008.
Am I doing my math right? Yeah.
I don't know. Probably. So I've been there 37 years, so it would be 15 years ago. So the work would have been like 22 years old.
Okay.
I mean, our work would have been 22 years old there. And so 15 years ago, we did what we call nationalizing the work. So up until then, the missionaries had been the top leaders of the work. I was considered the president of the work in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. And so we began working a little bit before that, probably about 2 or 3 years before that, in educating the people on qualities to look for in a president, what elections mean. And we had had elections for other positions, but never an election for the presidency. And so it was like teaching them, you're not looking for the most popular person, you're looking for the person who will give the spiritual leadership to the work that they need. And so 15 years ago, I would not let my name stand for elections, and we elected the first national president in Guatemala for the United Pentecostal Church. And that's what you call nationalization. Nationalization is when all of your leadership positions are filled by national people. Cool. And our job as missionaries then shift, and we become a support ministry for them. we become like an assessor to the president, an assessor to our national board. And it's a transition, but it's no more of a transition than a parent letting their children go.
True. Yeah, sure.
You know, they get out and get married, and sometimes you're like, oh, you shouldn't have made that decision. But you have to let them learn by their mistakes. And it's just the exact same thing with the national work.
Yeah.
There were times, there are some missionaries that will get a national work to that place and they will nationalize and they will leave. We decided to stay. And I felt like staying in Guatemala was the right thing to do because you become a stabilizing factor. And although you're not the president, you're sort of like the... maybe the bishop they'd call it here, or the grandpa.
The grandpa.
No, really.
Yeah, sure.
And they look at you like a stabilizing factor. And even to this day, you know, 15 years later, they hate it when I'm not there, when mm-hmm. I'm not there for a big meeting, because they feel that your presence, the history that you have. I mean, we've got 300 ministers in Guatemala right now. Probably 290 of them I taught in Bible school.
That's amazing.
You know, so
on Bible school, like obviously you've achieved this discipleship, you know, investing in people, that model. You've obviously been building church buildings, but you've built Bible colleges, plural, simultaneously. That's been, I would imagine, the main channel through which you've developed people, the Bible colleges?
Yes. Bible school in Guatemala is the very heart and soul of the work in Guatemala. We firmly believe in training and equipping for ministry. I almost prefer the term training center over Bible school because it is a training center. We're not just pouring information into people. We want to see their lives.
Hands-on stuff as well.
Yes, yes. Yep. And we want to see their ministries literally transformed. I look at it this way. The Bible is a book of transformation. Mm-hmm. Everything in the Bible is transformation. So if a student comes to the Bible school, we need to expect nothing less. Their lives need to be transformed. Their ministries need to be transformed. So I'm very, very passionate about that. Going into Guatemala, a country of, at the time, probably maybe 12 million when we first went there, and there's close to 17 million now, it would be impossible for a missionary to reach those people. But if you train and equip people, mm-hmm. and you multiply your ministry through others, then that's huge. I believe firmly that every child of God has ministry.
Yes.
I understand that a lot of them have a hard time finding what their ministry is. A lot of them don't even know how to go about doing that ministry. So I feel that as leaders, we have an obligation, number one, to help them discover what their ministry is. Number two, help them get placed in that ministry. And number three, train them and equip them so they can reach the greatest potential that they can in that ministry. And that's been really the basis of our work in Guatemala.
Yep.
And because of that, then we have another, I get talking about Bible schools and I could be here all day. But
that's all right. Go ahead.
We found that a lot of students could not come to our Bible school. And so we really changed our thought pattern. And our vision now is if you can't come to our Bible school, well, then we'll just take the Bible school to you. And so because of that, we're averaging around 30 Bible schools a year. Not all of them are brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. Some of them are held in local churches. Some are in schools. We've done classes under trees. You can do Bible school classes anywhere.
Yeah.
And so we have around 30 Bible schools. We average between 400 and 500 students a year.
There's no snow falling, you can have Bible college under trees.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Our trees in Guatemala still have leaves yeah. all year round.
And that's awesome.
And nice temperatures.
Sure.
And so, we take the Bible school to wherever it's needed.
Yeah.
And so we have three large Bible school complexes. Two are under construction right now. One is almost finished, and the other will be finished by the end of this year. And they serve as hubs. And then we have what we call extension programs, which go out from there, and they can go into the local, usually into the sections or districts or local churches. And that's where people are being trained for ministry.
So you know, as you look at the North American church, when I, as a North American, when I look around to the various mission fields, it seems like Bible colleges, training generally, discipling, investment in people, that seems to be a major focus and a point of success in a lot of thriving mission fields. So when you look at the North American church, do you think that that is an area that we could focus more upon? Of course, we have Bible colleges around the United States. Of course, right here in our backyard, there's Northeast Christian College. So it's not that there we don't have colleges, but even in a local church context, that maybe more of a focus on discipleship. Do you have any comments on that?
Okay, I think there's two things I would answer to this. Number one is, in North America, the focus of Bible school is usually young people. I think that more than young people are called to ministry.
That's very good.
And I think that we can adapt our programs to be all encompassing. I mean, we have in our Bible schools in Guatemala, we do day classes, we do night classes, we do weekend classes. We try to make it available so anybody can go. We try to make it affordable so anybody can go. And we do focus, because again, I believe everyone has ministry. I don't think that Bible schools are just for the forming of full-time ministers, but they could be a blessing to people that are teaching Bible studies, that are doing Sunday school, that are doing youth ministry, that are cleaning the church. Like, I think that there's so many ministries that we can help train them to be better at what they're doing. And so, and whether it's, so the second point is, so the first point is, I think that sometimes our focus in Bible school training is too exclusive.
To that younger demographic specifically.
Yes, it's not inclusive to the whole church. And so I think that's one thing. And also the way we approach Bible school, you know, you have to go for 3 years. And you have to leave your, so if you had a job, you'd have to leave your job. I think we can adapt. The world is a different place today.
So maybe this is a deep question. We don't need to, you know, go way far. But, you know, how can a local church do better just by, you know, trying to be more discipleship conscious?
So I think that, yes, discipleship is more than training new converts. I think that there's people sitting in the church pews that have been there for years and years that are frustrated because they would love to get involved, but they don't know how to. Some of them are embarrassed to say they don't know how to. And I think that if we made training more available, like, I deal with what they call the GATS program, which is a Global Association of Theological Studies. It is actually a curriculum for Bible schools. I was just contacted last week by a minister in the U.S. that wants to implement it in his church. Now, we don't work in North America, the GATS program. It's for something outside of North America. But we have a lot of churches and even districts in the United Pentecostal Church that follows our model or kind of uses the curriculum unofficially. And they just do it because why reinvent the wheel? And basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to train their people for ministry. And so I think that a local church needs to have something in place to really train and equip people for ministry and involve people in ministry. So often, it's 10% of the local church that does all of the work. I think we should flip that. I really feel that you want people to be faithful, involve them. You want the church to reach the community, involve them. And I think CCC is doing a really good job with that in so many different areas. But I really feel that training and equipping people is key, because I don't think it's a lack of wanting to be involved. I think it's a lack of having opportunity to be involved or overcoming that fear. And if we could train them and then place them and work with them, man, we would be like the New Testament church. We'd turn our world upside down.
Well, I think sometimes too, you know, obviously in a service style or in a service setting, there's preaching, there's inspiration, it's powerful. But if you don't have, you know, the instruction to accompany the inspiration, then it can frustrate people because they, it's like, you know, I'm inspired to do it. I want to do it. I feel like I need to do something more, but the what sometimes falls through the cracks.
And a lot of times in a moving service, there'll be an altar call. Like, if you want to work for God, if you want your life to count, come. So they come and they cry at the altar and then they leave and they're moved, but they're not giving a tool that they can use to change.
Very good. No, very good. Very good commentary there. Thank you for sharing. Is there any other contrasting points that you would make between, you know, the Guatemalan or the broader global church and the North American church? What's something that is the strength of North America? What's something we could do better? That's a loaded question, maybe, but
it is a very loaded question. I think when you look at North America, something that we can really pull into our countries, and probably it will come as generations go on, is excellence. I do believe with all my heart that everything we do needs to be done the very best that we can. Most people, when they come to Guatemala, are impressed with some of the facilities and some of the ways that our things are done there. And we do it to the extent in which we can. But North America does very good when it comes to fine-tuning the excellence side of things. I think that's really, really, really important. I think the Guatemalan church, and I'll speak from the Guatemalan church, and I've traveled a fair amount in other countries. I think the people focus in Guatemala is much stronger than North America. When visitors come into our churches, people jump up and go and welcome them and greet them, and there's a very good all-inclusive feel. Where in a lot of our churches in North America, we get very comfortable with the group that we have, and anybody that comes in from the outside are kind of looked at like, oh, who are they, you know, type of thing.
Sure.
And that's a very uncomfortable feeling.
Of course.
And so I think that focus, one thing I love about Guatemala, when you get done preaching, you don't have to give the altar call. The people do it. So when you tell them to stand, they're looking around, who can I take to the altar?
Yeah, come on, you're coming with me.
Yeah, and literally they do that. They will literally go and get them and bring them. They invite them to the altar. They talk to them about baptism. They talk to them about the Holy Ghost. Like it's a very cool atmosphere, and it's the way it should be.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's really neat.
Well, I think that goes back to what we were just talking about. I mean, they've been trained, they're engaged, they have a place, like they feel like that's their responsibility and their role.
Right, and in North America, everyone feels inhibited. Like, you're even paranoid about going to the altar yourself. Like, who's going to look at me? What are they going to think? Like, they think that maybe I'm struggling. You know, like, you know, people have those thoughts. Instead of being focused on other people.
Yeah.
And I think some of that, too, comes back to the personal walk with God. There's sometimes that people come to church and where they don't have a personal walk with God outside of church, then they have to make things right every service. And so the whole service becomes focused on them when really our focus in a church service should be twofold. It should be focused on worshiping God, but it also we should realize that we are here for the people who are not members of this church.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, our goal here is to reach Fredericton. Our goal is to reach Guatemala. And so the church is not about me, it's about them. And if we could change, oh man, if we could change that mentality.
It would change everything. It's powerful.
But that is a... That's a whole message for another day.
All right. I know we've talked about this before, but I just think it's worth repeating, and maybe we'll keep this one brief. But, you know, you've entertained or you've had aimers come, I should say, to Guatemala over the years. Give me, like, your synopsis of the ideal aimer for somebody that's listening and maybe would like to someday go on a short-term missions program.
To go to serve and not to be served. If an aimer could come with a servant's heart, it makes all the difference in the world. We have had some wonderful aimers who have come just with the idea, I want to lighten the load of the missionaries. I don't care what it is. I will do it. And if you could come with that servant's heart, then you could be a great blessing. Unfortunately, so many people that want to go, they want the recognition that I went, but there's laziness and there's preconceived ideas of what they will be involved in. And a lot of them don't have a willing heart to be involved in anything. I mean, when we first went on AIM, we worked with Brother Wynn Drost, who is a pioneer missionary. And oh my soul, I remember the very first national convention we had, some of the people from the villages thought the changing rooms was the bathroom. And they went in there, and after the convention, the aimer, me, got the job of shoveling those rooms out.
Enough said.
So, yeah.
Okay, I think that,
you got it.
Yeah, the qualifiers right there. Come with a shovel. I see.
Come with a shovel.
Well, no, that's
that'd be a good book.
Maybe that's the title of your of your new book. By the way, I feel like I should ask, when can we expect your book to come out, or is that just kind of like?
No, actually, we are slated for our next furlough in March of 2023, next year, and I am trying to have my book finished by the end of this year.
There we go. All right, you heard it here, maybe first.
That's first, yes.
Okay, good.
Now I have to get it done.
Yeah, now we're going to hold you to it. Yes. Exactly. I want to talk about this past COVID season, and not just COVID, but, you know, we were in prayer, at least we were right there alongside you as a church. I know that you kept in touch, most likely not just with us, of course, with churches around our fellowship, but the season, this past season has proven to be difficult. You can fill in the blanks for all the things I'm missing, but hurricanes, earthquakes, mm-hmm. And of course, COVID and a lot of death that came as a result of that, and famine. And, you know, if you want to comment on some of the events of that, but then I guess the thread through the question is, even in the middle of kind of those difficulties, what are some, how did you guys navigate that and come through with a smile on your face on the other side?
That's a great question. Okay, the last 2 years in Guatemala have been by far the most challenging years that we've had. They were very difficult waters to go through. They were uncharted waters, as everyone knows around the world. We went into COVID. It hit in March of 2020. I had just returned from Ecuador, where the first COVID case had just been detected. I got home. We had a team come in from St. Louis, Missouri, and Jim and Linda Poitras was with the team. We got them out of Guatemala on the very last flight.
Wow.
Like, literally, the country closed for 7.5 months as they flew off.
Wow.
We struggled to get them out. Like literally, they were scheduled to go to be there longer. And we managed to get them out, or we would have had some permanent aimers.
Not what they signed up for.
No. So when COVID hit, you know, it was like they were going to close the country for 2 weeks, which we all heard that. And
2 weeks to flatten the curve.
Yes, 2 weeks to flatten the curve. And we had the same thing in Guatemala. And it literally, the country was closed for 7.5 months. Like, the borders were closed. The airport was closed. And eventually, most businesses closed. Schools closed. Churches closed. 70% of the population in Guatemala was out of work. And when you get a country like Guatemala, where people live from day to day, most people do not have bank accounts. They do not have credit cards. Literally, what they eat today, what they eat tomorrow, is from what they made from money today.
Right.
And they don't have refrigerators to keep food in. They don't have freezers to keep food in. They buy it by the day. Markets were closed. Like, it was so devastating. So the government, you know, started trying to get programs, and churches started to get programs to help people. And the government said, if you do not have food in your home, post a white flag over your door. And immediately, white flags started going up all over the country. The streets were full of white flags when we were allowed to go on the streets. And so I really felt that the neighborhoods around our churches should be no flag zones. I really felt that. I felt that firmly, that we need to do something to feed the families around our churches, not just church families, but the neighbors. Like, what a great testimony if there was no white flags in the vicinity of United Pentecostal Church.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's so cool. And so I started reaching out. I reached out to CCC. I reached out to several churches, and I put it on Facebook. I put it out there in social media. And, I mean, CCC came through unbelievably with money, and friends and family from New Brunswick, from Ontario, from throughout the United States. We raised, well over $100,000.
Wow.
And for 7 months, and of course, at that point, I thought it was going to be for a few weeks. And we raised, for 7 months, we put groceries on the table of over 5,000 families.
Wow.
In Guatemala. We helped pastors who had no tithes coming in, had no offerings coming in to pay their bills, to stay afloat. If it was churches that were paying rent, we helped them pay the rent. Like, we did what we could to keep things afloat. And of course, we had no idea. Had I known in the beginning that it was going to be for 7 months, I would have had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have thought it was impossible, but it's God's provision.
Yeah.
Like, if I look back on it, I don't know how we did it. Like, mm-hmm. I honestly don't know how we did it. We had a store, a company in Guatemala that has like little stores all in communities all around Guatemala. And we went in and made a deal with them and got a good price on like a basic amount of groceries that a family would need, just staples.
Yeah.
And so I could go in there and I could buy like 1,000 of those. And we would send 50 to this village and 50 to this village and 75 to this village and 200 to this town. And our pastors could go to their little store in that town and pick those up and take it to the families.
That's amazing.
And it was an incredible plan, and it worked. And the money kept coming in, and we kept being able to do it. And we got through 7.5 months of closures, and I'm still fat. No, I mean, people ate and their needs were met.
They were fine.
Yeah. And it was incredible. And the church was the church. Mm. Because in my opinion, at a time like that, it wasn't an opportunity to cower down. It was a time for the church to shine.
And you guys did.
And I really believe that the United Pentecostal Church in Guatemala shone.
Mm.
And
amazing.
The cool thing was, so our churches were closed. When the churches reopened, we had 2 new churches.
Wow.
Like, in the midst of church closures, we grew 2 churches, and we literally baptized hundreds of people. I don't even know how many we baptized, but it was literally hundreds of people, because families that were not connected to the church would receive food, and then they would go and say, well, this person's sick, and can you pray for them? And we ended up baptizing entire families in Jesus' name. Mm. And I've seen this before in hurricanes and other disasters, that when you begin to meet the physical needs of people, they'll open their hearts to God.
Yeah, you meet the felt need.
Yes.
And then they become conscious of their
spiritual need.
Of their spiritual need.
Yeah, and it's unbelievable. So we went through that 7.5 months. The country reopened in September of 2020. And in November, we had 2 Category 5 hurricanes hit us. And the bad part was, we had an area of Guatemala that wasn't really affected too much by the closures, because it was agriculture. Mm-hmm. And they had food, okay? These two Category 5 hurricanes hit 2 weeks apart and took the exact same path and went right through the areas that were agriculture. Mm. And it was so devastating to Guatemala. We had entire towns underwater for weeks. Like, it was unbelievable. Guatemala is all mountainous. That's why we have such a beautiful climate. And the landslides. So just picture this. You have a house on a piece of property on the side of the mountain. If there's a landslide, you don't just lose your house, you lose your property.
Right, yeah.
You lose all your crops, you lose your animals, you lose everything. And so you're not just left without a house, you're left without a property
right.
that maybe was in your family for decades, and it's gone. And so the numbers are gone, maybe 18 churches that were either destroyed or severely damaged. We had, I want to say, 14 maybe pastors' homes that were lost, and hundreds of church families that lost everything. And once again, it went on social media. I made some calls. CCC came through again. Other churches came through, and we were literally, some of the churches that we're building right now are still churches that are being rebuilt from the hurricane.
Wow.
And the pastor's house, we were joking earlier because one of the pastors sent me a picture yesterday, and he just finished his home. He had lost his home in the hurricane, and he painted it purple, and there's pink on it. It looks like an Easter
We'll house. Display that photo. If you'll send it to me,
okay,
I'll put it on the podcast.
I will. And they're so excited. In fact, Tuesday was our minister's conference in Guatemala. I was not able to be there. He found my administrative assistant. And this church where he's at in his home is like way up in the mountains, about 12 hours from Guatemala City. You have to walk 2 or 3 hours to get into that community. There's no electricity in there. These people are very poor.
Mm-hmm.
But he went to my administrative assistant and gave him like the equivalent of $15 or $20 and said, please get this to Brother Brad and Sister Regina. I want them to go to a chicken restaurant in Guatemala, Pollo Campero. It's like Kentucky Fried Chicken, and have a chicken dinner on me to say thank you for what you did for our family.
Wow.
Like that. That tears you apart. But yeah, that's just, it's the greatest thing he could do to say thank you for rebuilding his home.
And I mean, I suppose things like that are how you keep a smile on your face, just seeing God, despite the struggle, he's still, you know, the church globally in North America rallying, I'm sure was a big help. But
oh, it was unbelievable. Like, and then being able to go in and help these people and see their response and how grateful they are, because who knows what would have happened.
Yeah.
You know, and it just is, it's just unbelievable what God has done. So the hurricanes hit, and that was very hard, and we were able to navigate through that. And then we had the fourth wave of COVID go through, and we lost, the fourth wave hit us very hard. Our national president, who at the time would have been 42, passed away from complications with COVID. He went in the hospital, and I talked with him on the phone, prayed with him on the phone, and the next day, or that night, we sent an ambulance, and they took him to the hospital, and in 2 days, he was dead. Then we had a couple pioneer ministers. We had a total of 11 pastors and 5 pastors' wives that died. 7 of them that died were Bible school teachers, and to us, this was a horrible, horrible blow. Training and equipping a minister takes many years to get them developed. Losing the president of the United Pentecostal Church of Guatemala was horrible, and it wasn't just the president, but he was a dear friend of ours. I taught him in Bible school. I married them. I walked his wife down the aisle as her, in her, like she didn't have a father. I was the father figure, then turned around and married them, and they have been dear friends of ours for years. And losing them, and then some of the other ones that we lost the main worship leader. Anytime we had conventions, he was our main worship leader and was the assistant pastor of the church that we make home. And I've known him since he was a child. And just, he was one of these people I could rely on for anything. And some, so losing some of these people wasn't just a blow to the work. We personally grieve deeply, and we couldn't grieve deeply. On the outside, we had to be strong for the people because these were such strong blows to our national work. And so we had to be strong for them, yet at the same time, on the inside, it was tearing us apart. And it was probably the hardest days that we've ever faced, losing so many at one time. And some of the people we lost have been people that have been a strong part of our work since our very early days in Guatemala. And it just was, it was crushing. And it was crushing to the work, it was crushing to us. But as missionaries and as the leaders, you they can see you grieve to a limit, but you've got to be the strong one. Mm-hmm. And you've got to, you know, be the one, the, you know, the church is God's, and it is. None of us have ownership. And God does have the church in his hands, and you just have to say, you know, we're moving forward. And even the new leadership that had to step in stepped in at a very difficult time, and we had to be there and be strong for them. You know, just very difficult.
So it was difficult, but...
But the church has come through it. And at the end of the day, you know, besides them, we lost hundreds of church members. And some of them were key families. One pastor called me, and he said, the founding family, the entire family's gone.
Wow.
And, like, that's hard blows to a local church and to a pastor. And but, you know, at the end of the day, we're living for God to make it to heaven, and these people have made it. Mm-hmm. And the church is still going to continue on. And you have to continue with the vision, and you've got to go to the next step and take the church to the next level. And through it, I mean, through COVID and through all that, we baptized so many people. We had new churches start. We're licensing new ministers. We had new ministers ordained this week in Guatemala. And so, you know, the work continues and God will bless it because the church is His. So it's not ours.
So even in those low moments, you just have to make a conscious choice. I am going to trust, even though I just can't perceive how God could be in the middle of this. You just trust that He is. And now looking back several months, a year, whatever later, you can see that.
Yes, you definitely can. You see that God does take the work on, and we've seen it through our lives and through the work in Guatemala, through other situations that have happened, but this was such a huge blow.
It's like a 1-2-3 punch, like just everything.
It was like a 1-2-3-11 punch. Like it was like, it was like beyond, and it was sort of like you would say, well, it can't get worse, and it did, and it can't get worse, but it did. And so you go through, you know, 7 months of having your churches closed, over a year of having your Bible schools closed, and then you lose your president, you lose 11 ministers, you lose pastors' wives, you lose some key saints in many churches, and it's just like what else, you know? But God has been so faithful in it all, and the miraculous provision that God has provided for when we had no, when people weren't working and churches responded, we made churches no flag zones. Then we helped with the hurricane, and then we helped the families with their, you know, losing their loved ones. We have a social program in Guatemala that, you know, if a pastor or pastor's wife die, you know, we help them. And but we didn't foresee 11 pastors and 5 pastors' wives dying at the same time. And I mean, we would have gone bankrupt if it wasn't for the North American church.
Yeah.
You know, they were right there with us. Every blow, we were together. Like and that really was an encouragement to me. I would have, your dad would call me, or friends in the States, pastors would call, and they would just would call at the right time and just give you a word and just encourage you and what do you need? And it really showed that we are a body. And we are beautiful. Working together.
Yeah.
And the work isn't ours anyway. You know, the work is God's. Sometimes we call it my church or, you know, my mission field, but it's not. We fool ourselves. We're one thing this does just teach me, we're all replaceable. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter who we lose, we're replaceable. Is it easy? No. But when, you know, if God chooses to take somebody home, He has somebody else to step in.
Yeah.
And because it's His church. And we see the church as this dot in time where He sees it from eternity to eternity.
Right.
And so we forget that sometimes, that we're just one little dot.
Yeah. We're all in a transitory role.
Yeah. And the church will continue.
And the church will go on.
Yeah. And the church does go on.
And it does.
So.
Well, I would have been remiss if we didn't at least talk about that season and just kind of get some of that sentiment. So thank you for sharing on that.
Yeah, and we are so grateful because to those of you from CCC that are listening to me or from any other church that has given, we could not have made it through this time without your prayers, without your support, without your giving. And we do not take it lightly. And we thank you from the bottom of our heart because we know that it was given out of love, out of sacrifice. And I also know that God will bless you for it, but God blessed Guatemala because of it, and we thank you.
That's beautiful and powerful. I want to try to land this plane, and I guess in a few moments I'll give you the last word, but before we get to that, I just want to give you the opportunity. If there's been any really impacting cool stories, testimonies, miracles of provision or healing or maybe even if there's a comical story, whatever, just anything that's been that's really kind of impacted you. I know we've talked about a lot of things that have impacted just even in our last little segment there, but any interesting or cool testimonies that you would just briefly share?
That sends my head in an absolute and total tailspin.
just too much.
Well, because through 37 years of ministry, for instance, miracles of provision are unending. It's very dangerous to ask, to tell a missionary, let me know if you need anything. Give me your phone number. because the needs are unending. There's just no end of needs. But God provides in incredible, incredible ways. I think maybe one of the most, and this is kind of a cool story, and we might have even touched on this when we did the drive thing. This is just a New Brunswick thing that impacted my life in the early years. When I first went to Guatemala, no, it was before I went to Guatemala, I made a, what they call now, what is it called? The AYC, Apostolic Youth Corps.
Yeah.
Back then it was called International Youth Corps, IYC. Okay. So Brother Steve Judd, who was the International Youth President, came to our home church to do Youth Week. I was the assistant youth leader at the time. I was just going into Bible school, and he was going to lead a team to Costa Rica and Panama that next summer, and he really felt strongly that I should go. I don't think they'd ever had a Canadian go on that before, and he really felt strongly that I should be a part of that. And he talked to me about it, and I just told him, I said, it's impossible. I said, my parents are helping me go to Bible college. I'm working part-time job at Kmart, and everything's going towards this, and it's just impossible. And he said, no, I really feel you should go. And I said, well, it's my parents would kill me, you know. And so he got up in church that last night and said, I feel that Brad Thompson should go on this trip. You know, he promoted the trip, and he just said, I feel that you should go on it. Had there been a hole in the floor, I would have, gladly fallen through it. I couldn't even look over towards where my parents were, because I thought, oh, yeah, they're going to be you know. And so when church get done, my parents said to me, if you feel to go on that, we will do everything we can to make that happen. And I'm just like, woof. And several other people came and mentioned it to me. And then on Sunday, Sister McConaughey, who I mentioned earlier, who lived across the street from us, for years I would shovel off her driveway. I would clean off her roof, snow off her roof, which if you're in the South, you probably don't understand that. And I would do grocery runs for her. I would do anything. And my dad always said, don't ever take money from her. And I would say, well, what do I do if she tries to give me money? He said, tell her to give it to missions. And so for years as a kid, when I wanted the money, you know, I'd mow her lawn and she'd say, well, let me give you some money. And I said, no, Sister McConaughey, just give it to missions. Just give it to missions. I didn't even know what that meant. It didn't even make sense to me at the time because I wanted the money. You know how it is.
Sure.
I was a kid. Well, that Sunday night, she came to me the next Sunday night and she handed me an envelope and she said, Brad, she said, for years you have cleaned off my walkway, you've mowed my grass, you've done grocery runs for me, and you've always said, give it to missions. And she said, now I want to give it to missions.
Wow.
And she handed me an envelope with the exact amount of money the trip cost. And that has been one of the impacting stories or impacting things in my life, because I didn't even realize I was giving when I was a kid. I did it because my dad said it, told me to do it. But, you know, all those times I was helping her, she was a pioneer Pentecostal minister's widow. He actually dedicated me as a baby. I didn't even know it.
Wow.
And so all those times, she was just an old lady across the street. But I was literally sowing into the work of God, and I was telling her to give it to missions. And I didn't even know what it all meant. But when it came time for me to go and make that first trip to a mission field, and that was a trip where God really dealt with me, but called me to work with the Spanish people. She came and she said, all those times, now I want to give it to missions. Bro, that has impacted my life during the last 40 years and made me realize that it doesn't matter what you do in the kingdom of God. God sees that, and it will come back to you. It may not come back to you in an envelope with money to go to Costa Rica and Panama, but it can come back in good health. It can come back with blessings on your family. You cannot sow into the kingdom of God without reaping the benefits. And to me, that has been that simple thing that Sister McConaughey did in handing me that envelope and telling me that has been a guiding force in my life ever since that happened. I can't explain it. It's just one of those those miracle moments that you step back and say, wow. And it causes all that happened before that in your life to kind of dovetail together and make sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a guiding factor. In going to Guatemala, there's so many needs. There's so many people that have needs. But, you know, I don't think we ever mess up in helping others. I don't think we ever mess up when we look at things from the side of compassion. Wim Drost always told me, if you're going to err on the side of compassion. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the Bible says the poor you'll have with you always. Yes, the poor is always there. There's always people with needs. But I think that if God blesses us to the point where we can bless and help others, whether it be monetarily, whether it be with our time, whether it be with our attention, whether it be a simple thing of shoveling out somebody's walkway, you don't know how that can come back, how it blesses them and how it can come back and bless you and bless your family down the road.
Absolutely.
And so I don't know. I know that's not a Guatemalan story.
No, that's a great answer.
But to me, it's one of those impacting stories. And we have seen God bless over and over and over and over and over and over again. We've seen God protect miraculously over again. And we were in Guatemala 13 years during war. And during the Civil War, we saw so many times where God miraculously protected us. And some of that will be in the book that I'm writing. That part's already written, actually, of just miraculous times that God protected us and literally had angels round about us.
Yeah.
Like, there's no question.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say again, thank you so much for the time today. And this has been powerful. I know it will be a blessing to so many. But as we close today, I try to do this often. I just want to give you the opportunity to leave us with the final word. The last voice our audience will hear today is yours. Just leave us with a challenging, encouraging, admonishing word, whatever you feel to say as we sign off today. And once again, thank you.
Well, I think that serving God is exactly what it says. Serving God. And I really believe that in Guatemala, when you meet somebody, you say, in Spanish, you say, yo soy Brad Thompson para servirle, which means I am Brad Thompson to serve you. That is a wide accepted greeting in Guatemala. If you don't know anybody, you'll say, you know, I'm Matt Woodward here to serve you. And they mean it. And I think that as Christians, if we could say, I'm Brad Thompson, God, family of God, I'm here to serve you. I really think that what could happen in our lives, what could happen in our church, would be absolutely and totally transformed. At the end of the day, we want our life to count for God. I want my life to count for God. I want my life to mean something. And so often we get caught in the, you know, 9-to-5, day-to-day struggles. And sometimes people look back at their life and say, well, what does it mean? I worked, I did this, I did that. But I really believe that if we would say to God, God, I want to serve. I want to be used. I want to be useful. You don't have to ever preach a sermon. You don't ever have to step onto the platform of a church. But if you would put your life into the hands of God and say, God, I want to serve. You don't even have to have a position. There are opportunities that's made available to us every day that if we would just open up our eyes, there are opportunities to serve and to touch people. If every day we can touch somebody, if every day we can help somebody, if every day we can make even a little difference, then our lives will count and our lives will impact. I can never get away from the thought and the truth that every one of us have a purpose. We were brought to this earth with a purpose. There is a divine purpose for our lives. It's my job to find that purpose and to allow myself to be developed to where I can reach my full potential in that purpose. The purpose doesn't have to be some great big huge feat, but we can be used of God how he wants to use us. And so I guess in ending, I just challenge you, find your place and give yourself 100% to it. It doesn't matter if you're seen. It doesn't matter if you're recognized. It doesn't matter if anybody even mentions it. But you know in your heart you're serving to the very best of your ability. And you know what? God will take your acts of service and he will bless them. Lives will be impacted and there will be eternal differences made. And that's really where it's at. I think it comes right down to serving in the kingdom of God. And every one of us, everyone that's listening to me right now, you can be used of God. You can make a difference, and your life will count in the great scheme of God's work in the kingdom of God.
Thanks again for tuning in to The Conversation. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to rate and review this podcast, share this episode with a friend, and subscribe for future content. This podcast is produced by Capital Community Church in Fredericton, New Brunswick. If you're in the area, we would love to have you for one of our weekly services. For service times and more information, please check out capitalcommunity.ca. We look forward to seeing you again next month on The Conversation.